Oh, I wish there was a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, then I'd root the mountains down. Oh, I wish there was a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there was John Otter's sunglasses. Oh, I wish there was John Otter's sunglasses. If I was not a sunglasses, I would show you messages hiding before your very eyes. Oh, I wish there was a book in a library. Oh, I wish there was a book in a library. If I was a book in a library, then I'd finally be free. Oh, I wish there was a book in a library.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland, Portland's community-owned and democratically run radio station. Welcome to the Old Mo Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Joe Clement is engineering. The Old Mo is dedicated to bringing you different perspectives on history, culture, politics, and current events than that of the corporate compromised news media. 100 years ago this month, in October 1917, a revolution in Russia changed the course of world history. Regardless of the denouement of that great social experiment, its beginning inspired great hope for many in the West, as well as Russia itself. In recognition of that inspiring beginning, Movie Mole's Jan Hocken and Joe Clement review one of the great films about those early days of the revolution, the 1981 Warren Beatty epic, Reds. I'll be sharing excerpts from a couple of articles on climate change and capitalism. But leading off today's program, Bill Resnick talks to Bela Ostrak about Catalonia's independence from Spain movement and the Catalans' democratic communalism and way of life.
Bela Ostrak, welcome to KBOO.
Good morning.
Bela Ostrak's an anthropologist, a radical, studying medical system, particularly women's reproductive health and rights. For several years, she lived in the Catalonia region of Spain, working at a women's health clinic and writing about how the economic crisis in Spain and the policies of austerity impacted women's life. That experience led her to a book, Health Policy in a Time of Crisis, Abortion, Austerity, and Access. Through her years in Catalonia, she got to know the independence movement that dates back a very long time to medieval Europe. It's now on the front pages of the New York Times and particularly all European papers as it struggles to free Catalonia from Spain's conservative neoliberal government. She's now writing on that independence movement. So, Bela Ostrak, at the end of the interview, we can discuss how the Spanish state has responded very brutally, unexpected levels of brutality, actually, imprisoning leaders, beating people away from the polling stations. And that's in response to a Catalonian referendum on the goal of independence. But before that, tell us about Catalonia, its history, its culture, and why it's been seeking independence from Spain in the first place.
Thank you. And I really appreciate the way that you set that up. I'll say one thing. So many of these headlines and even your very kind introduction framed it as that this is happening in Catalonia, Spain. What I learned very quickly when I first began going and exploring how to do research in this region is that the participants that I was working with, key informants and folks who were asking me to come do the research that I was doing, reject the framing of the place where they live as Catalonia or Catalonia, comma, Spain. So I was very quickly corrected and told, even in my very first conversation with the director of the clinic where I ended up doing my field work, this is not Spain. And you see that in graffiti on the streets. You see that in signs at countless protests. You know, this is something that was one of the main takeaways in my research is people say, well, why is Catalonia trying to leave? And what people constantly explain to me, you know, both on a large scale in terms of this national movement and on a small scale, just one-to-one conversations in my research, in my neighborhood, in my friendships, is people say, it is not that we want to leave Spain, it is that we want Spain and Europe to recognize that Catalonia existed before there was a Spain. In 1714, there was this takeover of the Catalan region for 300 years, for more than 300 years now, we've been trying to get free again. The 1978 Spanish Constitution recognized Catalan autonomy from Spain, and that really now since 2012, there's been this groundswell and this growing movement of wanting that to really mean something, for wanting there to be even more autonomy, for there to be a fully independent Catalan state and everything that would go along with that would set Catalonia fully separate in the ways that Catalonia is different from Spain, including fully funded, completely nationally provided health care, including for undocumented immigrants, which is one of the things that makes Catalonia different from Spain, to protect fully legal abortion, which Spain has been continually trying to roll back, to provide full education, full health care provided by the country to immigrants, to have more open borders for immigrants, which is something that Spain has also been kind of making noises about rolling back. And so what many Catalans and people who are recently arrived but welcomed and included in the definition of what it is to be Catalan, all of that is one of the ways that people who support independentism have been saying, this is what makes Catalonia different from Spain, and this is what we are trying to protect by becoming fully independent. Some people say, why would you support nationalism? And the way that I define this is to say, this is not far-right fascist nationalism. This is an inclusive nationalism, and it's something very different.
Let's talk about the policies themselves of the government of Spain and the lives that those policies require versus the life of Catalonia, which goes back a long way. Catalonian culture is very distinctive. People who go there say, boy, that's a different world. Mm. At least they used to. Now, Spain is trying to colonize Catalonia, actually, has always done it and wants to, in fact, break that culture, and along with other kinds of neoliberal impositions. But tell us about the Catalonian culture, its communalism, its egalitarianism, or am I being romantic?
No, I think that's a wonderful question, and it's something, this is another way in which we get sort of one hegemonic view, and I think this is true probably of many European countries and countries all over the world. I mean, this is part of the sort of neoliberal, neo-colonial mindset that I think we get in the United States about every country, but many parts of Europe probably get it about other European countries, that I don't think most people growing up in Spain probably know very much about the various autonomous regions, whether it be Catalonia, the Basque region, Andalusia. You know, I think many people, until they go somewhere else, don't know anything about that place, right? That's true for most of us. But in Catalonia in particular, there are particular communitarian and in particular sort of festival culture things that happen that, you know, you might on the surface think like, oh, this is just something that happens around a holiday, or this is just sort of colorful cultural activity, but that actually has layers and layers of deep political symbolic meaning behind it that are part of how people express political collectivist sentiment and work that was happening at a neighborhood or at a community or at a village level, particularly as forms of resistance to fascism under Franco. And so there were things, for example, that had been happening for hundreds of years that were a way of expressing Catalan collective work when, you know, after the Spanish takeover of the Catalan state, there were things that were happening at the village level. I'm thinking, for example, of the Castellers, the Human Tower Building, which is one of my areas of research now. For 2 years, I've been working with one of the neighborhood level human tower building groups in Barcelona, and they've now actually welcomed me as part of their group. So I go in the summertime and spend time with them and learn about what they're doing and what it means to them. I have a colleague, Nina Kammerer, who studies the giganteres, people who dance the large puppets. Someone who's just a visitor or a tourist might see that and think, oh, how interesting, how colorful, you know, what is this? What are they doing? And really, when you scratch the surface, this was something that was only allowed to be done in certain ways, and it was very restricted under Franco. Franco would only allow it if, for example, people who were participating would do a fascist salute at the end of a performance. only certain costumes were allowed. It could only be done in certain ways. It couldn't be done in any way that expressed anything that threatened fascist rule, or sometimes it wasn't allowed at all. It was suppressed. And then now, as the independentist movement has grown, some of these cultural and historic activities are being done in ways that are very political, that are very expressive of independentist movement. The group of human tower builders that I am a part of and that I do research with, they were the first group to officially declare themselves as an independentist troop. And now many Castellers, when they are performing, when they're building their towers, they will do it while wearing a Catalan independentist flag. So they'll climb to the top of their sometimes 7 or 8 story towers with a flag at the top. they also were one of the groups that was officially protecting the polling stations on the October 1st referendum. And so as people outside were trying to avoid being beaten by Spanish national police, there were people who are one of these cultural activities, these, you know, traditional 100-year-old Catalan cultural activities. The people who do this as a neighborhood cultural activity were defending the polling places, were inside at the voting tables, ensuring that people could vote. So what a tourist might see as a kind of quaint cultural activity is actually deeply embedded in communitarian, collectivist, political tradition, and is a way that people also welcome immigrants and refugees. You know, in the group that I work with, it's in a very it's a very immigrant kind of working class neighborhood where a lot of immigrants arrive. And it's also one of the places that newly arrived refugees are invited and welcome to come and learn about who in the neighborhood will help them find out where to go for services, where is a safe place that they can be. If they need to go somewhere, there's some programming in that group that is specifically about combating Islamophobia. So in the network of what happens, at least in Barcelona, you know, it may be different in some of the more remote rural areas, but at least in Barcelona, some of what we think of as, oh, it's a Catalan cultural activity, actually has a long tradition of inclusion, of embracing outsiders, and of saying our tradition is to take care of and protect each other.
This is Bill Resnick for the Olmo Variety Hour. I'm talking to Bela Ostrach. She's an anthropologist, and she's worked in Catalonia for a few years. Bela Ostrach, my understanding is that I'm not sure it's true of Barcelona, although it was true of it when I was there 40 years ago for a couple weeks. It's a different way of life in some ways, because just the way they people treat the relationship between their kind of daily tasks and work, and even work in the market for wages, and the rest of their lives. My understanding was, and my what I saw was, the cafes overflowing late at night often, people walking the streets, especially in some of the small towns around Barcelona, people didn't flee to their homes. The evenings were times when people celebrated together. Every day was sort of, in some ways, I mean, I'm going too far in romanticizing, but it was a very, very sort of collective social world where people met on a daily basis. People would meet in the bars and cafes and on the streets. Does that kind of culture still characterize Catalonia?
Yeah, and part of what's different, and I think in some sense some of that intensified as a result of the economic crisis, which really needs to be characterized as a crisis of capitalism. You know, I mean, people, some of what I've read in academic circles about the economic crisis is though it's something that just occurred, you know, that it was like this natural disaster, and really it was utterly engineered, right? I mean, it was a natural outcropping of capitalism. And, you know, and then beyond that, the way that Germany kind of shoved austerity down first Spain's throat, and then Spain passed it on disproportionately to Catalonia. And so the way that it was experienced in Catalonia, and I arrived in Catalonia in August of 2012, just as a lot of austerity measures were being passed on directly to Catalonia. And so I got there just in time to see the ways that, you know, first Spain told Catalonia to cut off all healthcare to immigrants, and the Catalan government said, no, we are not going to cut off healthcare to immigrants. That's not who we are. That is not a Catalan value. That is not what we do. So I immediately saw the conversations that were playing out among Catalans and among immigrants in Catalonia about what austerity meant. And in some ways, that sense of so many people were losing their apartments, so many people were on unemployment, so many people were in precarious work situations. And in some ways that intensified, I think, the existing feeling of people don't just go to their homes and sit alone with their nuclear families. And, you know, even the idea of the nuclear family is different because so many people are living intergenerationally, you know, their grandparents in the homes, especially in immigrant communities, which are often in what we would call suburbs, but that, you know, it's more that it's large housing blocks that are in the more outlying areas that are not quite in the town center, but that are in communities that are just around the kind of older parts of Barcelona that have been built up, that were built up more as kind of worker housing. As more and more immigrants from Spain came to live near Barcelona after the Spanish Civil War. So there's kind of large, almost Soviet-style housing blocks that are now actually being rapidly gentrified. And so there will be entire families living, you know, if not in the same apartment, then kind of in the same neighborhood. But people don't go home right after work. people are either meeting up for lunch in the middle of the day, or they're meeting up for a drink right after work, and then dinner is much later. So there's often several hours between work and when people would eat what we would think of as dinner, where people are hanging out. And that was already kind of a cultural standard is, you know, you meet up with people, whether it's your family members or your friends or your work comrades, you're meeting up and talking, and you're talking for several hours. And that conversation by 2012 was about the crisis. It was about austerity. It's about your friends and your family members who are out of work or are working a couple jobs all of a sudden, or work hours have been cut, and so you're working part-time, and you're worried about healthcare suddenly being not fully covered and not fully paid, or you're worried that you have healthcare, but your loved ones who are immigrants, oh my God, for the first time ever, is healthcare for immigrants not going to be covered in Catalonia? This is unheard of. This is not what we do here. And what does it mean that Germany is offering to bail out Spain, but only if Spain cuts off healthcare to immigrants? And what does it mean that Spain is telling Catalonia to cut off healthcare to immigrants? And what does it mean that we've just succeeded in gaining legal abortion, but Spain is now threatening to roll that back? And so one of the things that I experienced when I went to live there and began research there is I had never before in my life been anywhere except maybe El Salvador where political conversations were just automatic, where I didn't have to go into an activist or radical space to know that the conversation would be political. It was everybody. It was the taxi driver. It was on the subway. It was at the synagogue. It was at the bar. Everywhere that I was, people were talking about crisis, austerity, unemployment, people being evicted. You could walk down the street and run into a rally more weekends than not. And so it was that sense of, yes, people were together out in public spaces, in the plazas, at the cafes, but also that wasn't just a social thing. That was also an expression of political togetherness. And most people that I encountered just in my daily life, they didn't need to know that I was an anthropologist or that I was there studying the abortion law or studying the health system to want to talk to me about politics. And part of that public space thing is also that apartments are tiny, you know, so you wouldn't have friends over for dinner. You would meet them out for dinner. And I think partly that's the urban design and planning thing, that there are these plazas and the weather is great. So you go outside.
This is Bill Resnick for the Olmo Variety Hour. I'm talking to Bela Ostrak. She's an anthropologist and studies medical care. She's worked in Catalonia for a few years, got to know the what it's called the independence movement, but as she explained, it's probably better described as a liberation movement since Catalonia was basically taken over and very harshly supervised by the fascists. And even before that, there were efforts by the Spanish government to control Catalonia for actually hundreds of years. It really is a liberation movement. Bela, the movement itself is very heterogeneous, as far as I could see from my reading. In fact, for some period, it was a leader of a right-wing party who was the leader of the liberation independence movement. But it contains people of various political stripes. It's not likely that you're going to get a full-fledged radically democratic state featuring worker control of industries. The Catalan people may be not prepared for that. But what sorts of things could be one that would anticipate and continue and create momentum for a struggle for more democratic rights, for, in fact, challenging the whole market system?
Oh, that's a big question. I mean, I think a lot of it depends on how violently repressed the current efforts are. I think a lot of it depends on what other European countries allow Spain to do in response. And I think a lot of that is an open question right now. We're already seeing how violently Spain has repressed the current efforts, and the European countries that have come out attempting to be supportive have not been the strongest or the most powerful. Unsurprisingly, the U.S. has done nothing to try and support Catalonia, and the more powerful EU countries have done nothing to try and support Catalonia. So I think what Catalonia could do and what they would like to do has been a grassroots movement. So I think that's also important to back up and say is that in its current form and really for the last 5 years, what has been the most powerful and the most visible and the most promising independentist movement has been a very grassroots movement. It's led by the people, you know, the politicians that I think are most often seen in the European press right now, I don't think they're leading this. I think they are responding to calls by the people for what they are insisting on. And that's different than what it was. I mean, it is necessary to say, you know, when people talk about, oh, wasn't this kind of a xenophobic Catalunya for Catalans thing? You know, how can radicals and how can the Catalan left be supportive of this? I think in some ways that's a little bit overblown. There was one particular kind of right-wing party in a more rural area a while back. There was this, it got a lot of press. There was one particular pretty disgusting right-wing party that was supportive of the idea of independentism, kind of framing it as a way of not giving resources to immigrants. And that party was very roundly defeated in the next election and rapidly rejected by lots of other further left Catalan activists who said, no, that's not the point. The point is, within Catalonia, we want to decide how we can allocate resources, including for things like healthcare and education for immigrants. And the idea of who is a Catalan is also very different. You know, so part of the idea is Catalans are immigrants who come here and become union members and become students in the schools and become healthcare providers and become healthcare recipients. And so I think that has really shifted, you know, so that idea of who is a Catalan has become a much wider and more open idea. And so the independentist movement is a more left movement over time and is a more open movement over time. And the leadership has responded to that. You know, so the main body that is driving the independentist movement, the Asamblea Nacional de Catalunya, the National Assembly, it's a grassroots movement with neighborhood level representatives. So, I haven't heard people in the independentist movement talk about worker-owned cooperatives, but that doesn't mean there wouldn't be room for it because it's, as I said, it's incredibly grassroots and it's incredibly diverse. What I think is beautiful about the independentist movement is that it is something that has come from the ground up. It represents a wide diversity of people who are in Catalonia talking about what they want Catalonia to be and for whom. And deciding together in this very collectivist, communitarian way how they want to get there. And I think the limits on the possibilities of what it can be are largely based on how violently Spain is going to respond and how the rest of the world is going to allow Spain to do that.
Bela Ostrak, thanks so much for talking to us.
Thank you, Bill. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Right. So long.
Far and wide as the eye can wander, heath and bog are everywhere. Not a bird sings out to cheer us. Oaks are standing gaunt and bare. We are the peat bog soldiers. We're marching with our spades to the bog. Up and down the guards are pacing. No one can go through. Flight would mean a sure death facing. Guns and barbed wire greet our view.
Hi, folks. You just heard, this is Bill Resnick. You just heard Bela Ostrak, an interview with me on the Catalan struggle for independence from Spain, followed by the great anti-fascist song that was Paul Robeson singing. It was the Peat Bog Soldiers. The song was composed in the earliest Nazi concentration camps. That was between 1933, 34, and 35, and 36, before those men were all killed. They were marching off to the bogs to the Peat Bog Soldiers to get fertilizer and fuel for the Nazi machine, and then they knew they were being killed. The Peat Bog Soldiers, the song that the socialists and communists both together composed and sang in the concentration camps, it became the anti-fascist anthem in World War II, including for the international brigades during the Spanish Civil War. It then became a song of resistance during the World War, at least for the left. That war preceded, the Spanish Civil War preceded World War II. The U.S., of course, stayed neutral, effectively supporting the fascists, And after the fascists were defeated, the Western, quote, democracies supported the fascist Franco. Why? Because they were afraid that the Free Spain and Free Catalonia especially would move too towards socialism, of a very different variety, perhaps, than the Soviet Union. That would be the hope, certainly among the Catalans. The concentration camps appear to be the one place where socialists and communists cooperated in the war, not cooperated before the war. That is, the German socialists and communists, and they cooperated in the concentration camps. They didn't cooperate in Germany. They survived. Some of them did better in the concentration camps and lived longer because they were cooperating. Of course, if had they cooperated in the war, on the outside, in Germany in the early 1930s, the socialists and communists would have won the 1937 election and Hitler would not have come to power. The socialists and communists together got more votes than Hitler, but Hitler got more votes than either of them, became the premier, and of course, set himself on a program to kill everybody who opposed him. So it's a long story. Although, had they cooperated, they probably would have lost anyway to the fascists, because in the pre-World War II period, the people in power, mostly liberals, could not control the courts or the police or the army, who were very conservative, and they turned to the fascists to restore law and order. So Hitler, of course, when he did a coup, had 6 months of luxurious jail time, and communists and socialists were all being executed. That is, by the courts and the army, even in that pre-World War II period. Anyway, that's a good lesson for today's anti-fascists. It really doesn't do any good to throw marbles at police and to see them as your enemy. We have to reform, change the police and change policing in very, very different ways. Anyway, this is Bill Resnick commenting on the rise of fascism and how to confront it.
Viva la quinta brigada, rumba la rumba la rumba la. Viva la quinta brigada, rumba la rumba la rumba la. Ese advierte de gloria a Emanuela, a Emanuela. Ese advierte de gloria a Emanuela, a Emanuela.
Thank you, Bill. And this is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. In the month of October 1917, exactly 100 years ago, an event occurred of world historical importance. I am speaking of the October Revolution in Russia, which gave birth to the Soviet Union. While the event caused alarm in all the capitals of the West, it was greeted by many Western intellectuals, progressive and idealists, as a potential dawning of a new and glorious chapter in world history, in which humankind would finally commence the long march towards universal justice and equality. As an example of the euphoria which the great event aroused in the West at that time, I'm going to read a short passage from one such Westerner who traveled in Russia shortly after the revolution. Nikos Kazantzakis, the Greek atheist mystic and author of Zorba the Greek and The Last Temptation of Christ, wrote in full Hegelian mode in his great confessional autobiography, Report to Greco. Beyond all reasoning, beyond learned bickering, beyond economic needs and political programs, above Soviets and commissars, is the spirit of our times which operates and directs here. All from the most bestial peasant to the saintly figure of Lenin are its conscious or unconscious collaborators. This spirit is higher than programs, higher than leaders, higher than Russia. It blows above them, leaves them behind, and mobilizes the world. End quote. However, Kazantzakis goes on to add in a less ecstatic mode, the creation of this civilization is not assured. In no creation is anything assured beforehand. The future may be a total catastrophe, but it may also be the triumph of a creative breath. End quote. In recognition of the great hope this creative breath initially aroused, Jan Hocken and Joe Clement are here to talk about one of the great films that was inspired by the Russian Revolution, Reds, written and directed by Warren Beatty, and Beatty and Diane Keaton in the leading roles. This film has been described as the story of a radical American journalist who becomes involved with the communist revolution in Russia and hopes to bring its spirit and idealism to the United States.
Good morning. Reds is Warren Beatty's 1981 epic film about American revolutionaries during the time leading up to and right after the Bolshevik Revolution. In particular, it focuses on Jack Reed, played by Beatty himself, and his love interest and eventual wife, Louise Bryant, played by Diane Keaton. Reed is a Portland-born and raised journalist, a communist activist, and a member of the Industrial Workers of the World. Bryant is a feminist journalist and artist in a lackluster marriage to a well-regarded Portland dentist. The film starts with how they meet in Portland during the politically contentious period preceding the U.S.'s entry into World War I. Bryant already admires Reed from a distance, and when she finally gets to meet him, they hit it off, talking all night about politics and art, and he asks her to leave stuffy Portland with him for New York and bigger things. Throughout the film, we see them meeting and working with other radicals like Emma Goldman, played by Maureen Stapleton, Louis Freyna, played by Paul Sorvino, and Big Bill Haywood, played by Dolph Sweet. They agitate against the war in Europe while organizing the workers for class war and participate in the October Revolution of 1917 in Russia. Weaving the personal and the political, they also advocate for journalistic authenticity against political correctness and struggle with the challenges and hope of free love, or love at all, as revolutionaries. Well, Jan, I think the one thing that a lot of people have remembered this film about is its love story, and we both admire it for being what it is as a love story, but also because it seems to bring the political into the film in a way that most love stories I don't think ever have, when there has been political issues surrounding it.
And it's a remarkable film in not sacrificing the political to the personal. Often the criterion for a watchable movie is whether the characters, the romance, the individual stories are the primary kind of motivating dynamic of the film. And often the politics are very much a backdrop to the personal story. And here, I think it's a remarkable film, especially for a film that came out of Hollywood, in that the personal love affair, which is at the center of the film, is so inseparable from the political passions that draw them together. And both are compelling. And indeed, at one point when the Reed character charges that you have to have individual passions and acknowledge people who need to be together out of love, that a revolution has to have a place for both politics and individual passion. And I think the movie attempts to bring that same message forward.
Yeah, what you're referring to is this really great speech that he gives at the end of the movie, really kind of the climax, where he finds out that some of the party officials had redacted and changed a speech that he had given to working class or near proletarian people in the Middle East. And instead of translating what he said as class war, they made it jihad and holy war against the infidels of the West. And he lays out the stakes of the whole film, and I think really kind of the period of, you don't have a self to give if you were not fighting for being somewhere in between the individual and the collective.
And carrying both. Although in terms of the aftermath of the Bolshevik Revolution, I think it's always difficult to handle these revolutionary periods without bringing a terrible, bitter disappointment, despondency, and of course, looking back on that period and its promise, it can often be cast as a kind of misguided idealism, and I think that's one interpretation of both of them, that they were kind of captured in the romance of the historical revolutionary period and blind to the potential downfall. But I think one can also look at the film as inspiring in terms of the possibilities of revolution, all of which are, I think, have their own historical complexities, but are inevitably complicated and messy.
Yeah, a number of reviews will mention how there is that idealism there, but they also appreciate how the actors, the primary actors of this story anyway, are not entirely blinded by it. They're struggling with these issues because they haven't simply given them up to the revolution, although in the end you see Jack Reed become more convinced of what the party was telling him about how the revolution needed to proceed. There's this really kind of, for me anyway, depressing conversation between him and Emma Goldman where he says, what did you think the revolution was going to be? This sit-down conference over coffee, and we're going to come to a consensus about how everything should be.
I think more important than than this as a primer, the film Reds, as a primer on the Russian Revolution and its aftermath and the assessment, which is a very complicated issue to take up seriously, and a film can't possibly provide an adequate assessment of that. I think more important is how the film can remind us of the left history that we have been deprived of as a country, and indeed I think is an interesting part of Portland's left history that most people I think aren't aware of.
Yeah, Jack Reed was born and raised in Portland. He came from a modestly affluent and comfortable family, but he was, you know, really, he didn't find appeal in a lot of their politics and just the way that they looked at how people should build their lives. And he quickly got involved with the IWW in Portland. And
International Workers of the World.
Industrial Workers of
Industrial.
The World. And he, at the time, thought that the IWW Hall, which was downtown at like 5th and Davis, I think, at the time, was the height of intellectual debate and, you know, where people were actually thinking about the world in a way that seemed sane and like it was looking towards making reasonable changes. And this is a theme that repeats through the movie, his insistence on the importance of the IWW, but also his commitment to the workers being the ones driving the revolution to what it's all about. There's this great interplay between two scenes where earlier in the film, and he's getting involved in party politics, he is asking a question when he is not already a member of the Socialist Party, and he's asked, "What credentials do you have?" And he says, I'm nothing. I'm just a journalist here." And they kick him out for not having credentials. And yet later in the film, when he's already in Russia and goes to a factory where workers are considering whether to strike, and that would mean closing down the supplies to the war front, he kind of modestly says, "Oh no, I can't speak on anyone's behalf here. I don't have the right credentials." And this Russian worker who happens to speak English says very kind of boisterously, "What are you talking about? Everybody here has credentials." And he's constantly reaffirming how it needs to be the workers that lead this and whose interests are being carried forward.
Yeah, the Socialist Party on this side, it seems quite sectarian and caught up in I think mysterious divisions that are not explained in the film, but I think you do get a sense of there being a very vibrant socialist and communist history to the U.S., where there are issues that are being struggled over, the importance of World War I as a kind of watershed in revolutionary politics, and the importance of opposition to the war and the heroic efforts of people like Emma Goldman and Louise Bryant and John Reed in opposing U.S. entry into World War I. And how important the war was and the aftermath of the war and with the collapse of the old empires and kind of the emergence of new hopes for a new world order after that period. So I think the film also could be criticized for how it does portray Louise Bryant, the Portland writer who was cast as a free spirit, bohemian, and became a more serious character throughout the film. At one point, she has a conversation with Emma Goldman, the anarchist who has been acknowledged as an important figure in the history of feminism, the history of the American left. She's introduced to Louise Bryant, who by then is partnered with John Reed, and she asks, "Well, what do you write?" And Louise Bryant says, "Well, anything and everything." And Emma Goldman looks blankly at her and turns away. And that scene kind of captures, I think, some of the invisibility of Louise Bryant in the film itself, or the downplaying of her work. She became a serious writer and was a serious feminist in her own right. The role of sexual politics and sexual independence were very important to radical visions of feminism during that period. It was not just that she was a defiant, runaway wife.
Yeah. She's constantly referring or disapproving of possessiveness in her relationships with people and in general. And there's some really tense scenes between her and Jack Nicholson, who plays Eugene O'Neill, the famous playwright and poet who is an alcoholic and just generally kind of a curmudgeon of a guy, but who falls in love with her. And he is much more kind of old-fashioned and romantic, and as she puts it, wants something much more serious with her than she thought that she was ready for, that he could handle if she said no to. But by the end of the film, or towards the end of the film, when she's kind of broken out of her shell of a self-important writer and is, you know, writing about serious things and is giving her lectures on her time in Petrograd, because she went to Petrograd with Jack Reed during the time when they both collected the information that he would publish in his world-famous report called 10 Days That Shook the World. And when she finally comes back to Russia after many years, Emma Goldman had been deported. All the alien communists in the late teens had been deported. Emma says, you've changed, or I was wrong about you, and is, I think, giving that glimmer of recognition that, at least over the course of her life, which is all we can look back to now, that she did find a place to do something important.
Yeah, and this is Jan Hocken and Joe Clement talking about the 1981 film Reds. What about the industrial workers of the world and the portrayal of that? I think that's also a part of Portland and broader left history that has been forgotten by many. And I think it was very central to the film, and perhaps today as a tradition that emphasized organizing workers beyond the industrial base, but yeah, all a broader conception of workers as part of a larger revolutionary movement.
Yeah, well, the Industrial Workers of the World was founded in 1905 from a conglomeration of different political parties and unions. And the one big figure that we see in the film is Big Bill Haywood, who was a leader from the, I believe, Western Federation of Western Miners. And a lot of the IWW's work happened in the Pacific Northwest because a lot of the industry at the time to organize was extractive industries, mining for one, but also logging. And Portland was became a hub of a lot of the free speech fights. Spokane, Washington, as well as Seattle were big places where the IWW was speaking out against the ways that the relatively conservative unions that were grouped together by the American Federation of Labor, which survives today as the AFL-CIO, the CIO is the Congress of Industrial Organizations, they spoke out against the way that the AFL and those craft-based unions would reject people based on their race, based on the fact that they may not be part of a lucrative field that, you know, essentially would be good for paying dues. And their motto in the preamble of the IWW Constitution is not a fair day's wage for a fair day's work, but the abolition of the wage system altogether. And they saw that making the world better for workers wasn't simply getting a bigger piece of the pie, but, you know, taking over the bakery, as it were.
Yeah, and I think part of the importance of that movement and the radical vision that was at the center of the film was how exciting and interesting life it can be as a revolutionary. And I think the film did not downplay the moral crises and the difficulties of becoming invested in something that disappoints you, but I think it did a fair job of capturing the value and the excitement of a politically committed life as revolutionaries.
Yeah, what I found most compelling about the film was that we look back at this time, the founding of what would eventually be the Soviet state, and we see that it's not just people being driven by an ideology that's handed to them by a party. Of course, there is some of that, and that's eventually what a lot of things kind of devolve into, but people are motivated by their own passion for a better world and their own, I would hazard a call, intuitive sense of right and wrong, mm-hmm. that pierces through a lot of the ideology about war and capitalism in general.
And their ethical commitments and that they struggle with over time. That it, I think the film at least attempts to capture the complexities and challenges of an ethical life.
Well, Jan, I think that's all the time we have for our conversation. I wanted to play an excerpt from a song by Leon Rosselson, which I also think captures a lot of the hope and aspiration that people felt at the time. And it's called Song of the Old Communist from his album Voz in the Elephant album.
I was only a lad when we read that in Russia the workers, the Soviets, had taken all power, and the man they called Lenin who led them was our inspiration. His triumph was our finest hour, and I'll always remember how fear shook the wealthy like thieves who have just been caught out in their crime. But we, who had known only war and the workhouse, rejoiced that a new world was born at that time. You can't know what it meant, and the pride that we felt to know working people, people like us, could shake off the shackles, could topple the palaces, remake the world without ruler or boss. It was this kept us going, this dream of a new world, through all those dark years of defeat and despair, when we, who were proud to proclaim ourselves communists, fought for that world free from hunger and fear. It was down with a means test, no cuts in our wages, we want £3 a week and the 7-hour day. And there wasn't a thing that we got, but we fought for it. Don't you know bosses give nothing away? And you, who have nothing at all to believe in, are you whose motto is money comes first? Who are you to tell us that our lives have been wasted and all that we fought for has turned into dust?
This is the Omo Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. It is no longer appropriate to sound the alarm that we must start immediately to deal with climate change, or we are going to be in very big trouble in the near future. That future is here. We are already in big trouble. Unprecedentedly violent hurricanes following one right after the other. One of the most destructive wildfires in California history continues to rage. And that's just the U.S. Violent storms are increasing in number and severity all over the world. Today I'm going to share excerpts from two articles that are sounding that alarm. The first is by Connor Lynch, entitled Climate Change and Capitalism. We can't confront one without facing the other. Amid this devastating storm season, Lynch begins, we must talk about climate change and the economic system behind it, the bleak reality of what we face in the decades to come if we do not deal with climate crisis today, with sadly on display as historic floods engulf the most populous city in Texas, displacing tens of thousands of people and causing up to $190 billion in damage, followed by Irma generating some of the most powerful winds in recorded history. Note this article was written before Hurricane Maria and the California wildfires. It's becoming impossible to ignore the real-life consequences of global warming as extreme weather events become ever more prevalent. After Harvey, a consensus seemed to form among experts that we cannot talk about these disasters without talking about climate change. On CNN.com, environmental activist Mark Linus went one step further when he declared that we now have a moral duty to talk about climate change and to resist the attempted conspiracy of silence imposed by powerful political and business interests opposed to any reduction in the use of fossil fuels. We owe this to the people of Texas as much as to those of Bangladesh and India and Niger, wrote the prominent environmentalist. Linus obviously isn't wrong to link climate change to extreme weather we've experienced around the world over the past few weeks. Climate scientists have been warning of more extreme weather for two decades now. Linus also isn't wrong to say that we have a moral duty to talk about climate change in light of Harvey, as well as the devastating monsoons that ravaged South Asia, which killed more than 1,000 people. The fact that many American politicians, including the current president of the United States, still deny that human-caused climate change is a real phenomenon that threatens our future is a moral disgrace. By rejecting climate science and thwarting efforts to combat the growing crisis, Donald Trump and his fellow Republicans are ensuring many more historic storms like Harvey and Irma in the future. It is a moral duty, then, not only to discuss climate change after Harvey, but to shame Republicans who are currently accelerating humanity's extinction. But it goes beyond simply discussing climate change. We also have a moral duty to talk about the economic system that has brought us to this point. That is, we can no longer talk about climate change without talking about capitalism, which has laid waste to our planet and now impedes humanity's effort to deal with the climate crisis it engendered. Simply put, capitalism is an economic system that prioritizes short-term profits over the long-term good of society and the planet, and as a result encourages myopic self-interest that often has dangerous long-term consequences. This is evident in the behavior of multinational corporations that put profit over people. Capitalism is also a system that is based on endless growth, which has been sustained over the past few centuries by the depletion of our natural resources. It is becoming increasingly clear, however, that this addiction to endless growth is unsustainable on a planet with finite resources, and like all addictions, it will eventually backfire spectacularly. Capitalism has brought unprecedented material progress to humanity over the last 300 years. Even Karl Marx once wrote of the great civilizing influence of capital. But he also recognized the economic system's inherent destructive tendency, and he realized that corporate capitalism does not offer a sustainable future on planet Earth. If we fail to make radical changes to our economic system, the chances of successfully confronting climate change decline precipitously. And if we fail to confront climate change now, nature will surely take its revenge on all of us in the future. That was an article entitled Climate Change and Capitalism: We Can't Confront One Without Facing the Other by Connor Lynch. Connor Lynch is a writer and journalist living in New York City. The article can be found on the Salon.com webpage. The other article I want to share excerpts from today is by Mark Hertzgard, entitled Climate Denialism is Literally Killing Us. The horrors hurled at Houston and the Himalayan lowlands in late August were heartbreaking, but also infuriating. How many times must we see this disaster movie, titled Hurricane Harvey in 2017, Hurricane Sandy in 2012, and Hurricane Katrina in 2005, along with many lesser-known foreign releases, before we intervene and change the ending? And how long before we hold the ultimate authors of such climate catastrophes accountable for the miseries they inflict? At least 60 people died in Texas because of the storm. Over 1 million people were displaced, and who knows how many survived but lost everything. Multiply the death and destruction in Texas 100-fold to comprehend the scale of devastation in India, Nepal, and Bangladesh, where, although the news coverage has been a fraction of Harvey's, a staggering 16 million children are in urgent need of life-saving support after torrential monsoon rains and catastrophic flooding. What makes this so infuriating is that it shouldn't be happening. Experts have warned for decades that global warming would increase these sorts of weather extremes and that people would suffer and die if protective measures were not implemented. Many other experts have issued warnings, starting with NASA scientist James Hansen's landmark 1988 Senate testimony that global warming had begun and, if left unchecked, would threaten the future of human civilization. Yet Donald Trump and other powerful know-nothings in Washington seem perversely determined to ignore the lessons while doubling down on making things worse. Trump has crammed his administration full of climate change deniers while pushing full steam ahead on more oil, gas, and coal production. His EPA chief, incredibly, has urged governors to ignore the Clean Power Plan proposed by the Obama administration, aiding conservative efforts to gut the policy. Days before Harvey drenched Texas, Trump rescinded Obama's requirement that federal agencies take climate impacts into account before approving major infrastructures. And in a stunning insult not only to climate preparedness but the legacy of U.S. space exploration, Trump nominated a climate denier with no scientific training to run NASA. When the president announced in June that he was withdrawing the United States from the Paris Climate Accord, I wrote in The Nation, I being Hertzgard, to refuse to act against global warming is to condemn thousands of people to death and suffering today and millions more tomorrow. This is murder, even if Trump's willful ignorance of climate science prevents him from seeing it, end quote. That judgment goes more apt with each passing day, and if we don't reserve course. Knowing that what we know in 2017, expanding fossil fuel productions like big tobacco contributing to addict people to its cancer sticks, technically legal, but in effect premeditated murder. It's past time to call out Trump and all climate deniers for this crime against humanity. No more treating climate denial like an honest difference of opinion. When big tobacco executives swore to Congress that nicotine wasn't addictive, their assertion, though laughable, did not make it true. 46 state attorneys generals forced these companies to pay at least $206 billion for their wickedness. Now the individuals and institutions pushing climate denial must be talked out with even greater vigor in newspaper columns, on TV and radio talk shows, in town halls, at the ballot box, and by consumer boycotts, legal investigations, shareholder resolutions, street protests, and more. The first step toward justice is to call things by their true names. Murder is murder, whether murderers admit it or not. Punish as such, or we encourage more of the same. That was an article by Mark Hertzgard entitled Climate Denialism is Literally Killing Us. Hertzgard is The Nation's investigative editor at large and is the author of 7 books, including on Bended Knee, the Press and the Reagan Presidency, the article being found on the Nation's webpage.
Oh, where have you been, my blue-eyed son? And where have you been, my darling young one? I've stumbled on the side of 12 misty mountains. I've walked and I crawled on 6 crooked highways. I've stepped in the middle of 7 sad forests.
Luchamos contra los moros, rumba la rumba la rumba la. Luchamos contra los moros, rumba la rumba la rumba la. Mercenarios y fascistas, a Emanuela, a Emanuela. Mercenarios y fascistas, a Emanuela, a Emanuela. En el frente de Arama, rumba la rumba la rumba la. En el frente de Arama, rumba la rumba la rumba. No tenemos ni aviones, ni tanques, ni camiones. Ay, Manuela. No tenemos ni aviones, ni tanques, ni camiones. Ay, Manuela.
Of course, the song was Bob Dylan's Hard Rain, about a nuclear holocaust, but we're facing a new possible holocaust. Why I chose to play that song. And then that was followed by a song I think you chose,
yes,
Will, and you were going to make some commentary on it.
It's the Pete Singer playing the song Long Live the 15th Brigade, which was the international brigade, men and women from all over the world, thousands from the U.S. and the Abraham Lincoln brigades. They joined the left in Spain and were defeated by the fascists. Long Live the 15th Brigade. That, of course, is a song for us. And we could all join the 15th Brigade. The song ends with the words, "We will fight on other fronts." It's a wonderful fight song.
Thanks, Bill. And that concludes our program for today. You've been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Joel Clement has been our engineer. Tune in next Monday for more interviews, reviews, and commentaries that reflect the Old Mole mission.